There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversation? And how do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we bring the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day? That's our role and responsibility as Christians in the culture, not only to seek to cultivate the mind of Christ and seek to cultivate for ourselves a biblical worldview, but then actually to speak into the cultural conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. People don't actually need another piece of our mind. They don't need another opinion piece, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So I think that you and I are just the people to give it to them. I invite you to connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. I write about all kinds of stuff that I don't have time to share here in the hour on the air. So if you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and you could sign up for the podcast, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You can always go to Facebook and like The Reconnect. Actually, on Facebook today, I have sparked a conversation about the Starbucks new holiday cup. You can't engage in that conversation with me anywhere but on Facebook, because that's the easiest place for people to freely post their comments. So there you go. If you want to engage in that conversation, which I'm going to be talking about in tomorrow's show, I'd encourage you to go and do that. So on Facebook, look for The Reconnect or look for me, and you can engage right there in the conversation about the Starbucks holiday cup. It's, by the way, not just red this year. Okay, there you go. You can follow me around on Twitter and comment there. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. All right, friends, the Houston Astros won the World Series last night. I actually have two things to say about that. Number one, for one guy on the team, it was in fact not the greatest thing that happened yesterday. So for one Houston Astros player, the greatest thing that happened yesterday was not that his team won the World Series, but that during a live interview following the game, when he got down on one knee and proposed to his girlfriend, Miss Texas, USA, Daniela Rodriguez, she said yes. He said, "Will you make me the happiest man in the world? Will you marry me?" And she said yes. Why do I bring this up? Because apparently men and women out there have different views of whether or not this was a good idea. Lots of guys out there actually think that, you know, he should have just stuck with the win. He should have just stuck with the let the victory over the Dodgers stand as the greatest thing that happened yesterday. And instead, you know, he somehow soured that or messed that up or complicated it by asking his beloved to marry him. Women are swooning. So in case you ever wanted to know, is there still a difference between men and women? Yes. In reaction to this one story, we have plenty of evidence that men and women are actually different. We see this as a great romantic thing. Marriage still matters. And It's still in the heart of hearts greater than winning a game, even with your pals. All right, so marriage still means what it has always meant, and marriage is not only good, it's good for you, just like God designed it to be. And so I just think that we want to be mindful any time that a marriage between a man and a woman, especially a guy willing to get down on bended knee and ask his beloved to marry him in a very public way. I mean, like, anything could happen. That's a little risky. And we want to celebrate that. We want to be people who are actually celebrating the goodness of God's gift of marriage between a man and a woman. So just want to celebrate that little note about the Astros' victory over the Dodgers last night. Also want to celebrate this. I don't know if it's a celebration. It's more like an acknowledgement of Sports Illustrated. I don't often talk about Sports Illustrated, not really sort of in my wheelhouse of regular commentary, but here we go. Sports Illustrated, CNN says, should possibly start predicting the stock market. That caught my attention. I'm wondering why CNN thinks Sports Illustrated should start predicting the stock market. Well, here's why. So the Sports Illustrated, the magazine, actually anointed the Houston Astros as your 217 World Series champions more than 3 years ago. In fact, in the June 2014 issue of Sports Illustrated, so again, more than 3 years ago, Sports Illustrated picked the 2017 Astros to win the World Series. And what exactly happened last night? The 2017 Astros won the World Series. Now, you say, well, maybe it was totally predictable. No. In June of 2014, when Sports Illustrated put the Houston Astros on their cover and declared that they would be the World Series victors in 2017, the Astros were the worst team in baseball. They were in last place. And here is what the Sports Illustrated rep said or wrote last week about this. It says, We settled on 2017 because the Astros' young nucleus, again, this is back in 2014, would by then, which would be by now, reaching its prime. It was certainly a long shot, but so is everything in baseball, he says. So CNN is suggesting that maybe Sports Illustrated should start predicting the stock market, and then they conclude this way: we are now eagerly awaiting Sports Illustrated's prediction for the 2020 presidential election. Well, there you go. A little harder to predict the 2020 U.S. presidential election, since we don't actually know who's in the running yet. It's a little easier to predict, you know, like baseball 3 years out, because you can actually look at a team and see who, you know, see who's going to be around 3 years from now. All right. Anyway, I thought that was kind of fun. The word prophetic has been used to describe Sports Illustrated's predicting of this particular outcome of this particular game, which just leads me to want to ask, because, you know, we're trying to bring the Christian worldview to bear on everything. So how, as a Christian, are you going to enter into this conversation? Well, you can actually have a conversation about what it means to be prophetic, and whether or not this is prophetic, or if this was actually really fantastic analysis. The word prophetic, a prophet is literally a mouthpiece of God, one who speaks on behalf of God. Now, you and I tend to think of prophetic as being that which can tell the future, telling that which lies ahead. Prophets actually were more apt to just speak the truth to power than they were to foretell the future. They would often let folks know, like, hey, if you continue down the path that you're on, this is likely to happen. And God has revealed that if you would do this, then these outcomes would be different in these ways. So there are prophetic predictions that take place, this forthtelling or this prophetic foretelling. But most prophetic speech is actually speaking truth to power. And so I just want you to remember that when you see that word and you wonder how it's being used in our culture, that's really the derivative of what it means biblically. All right, turn our attention back to New York City as we continue to follow the story of the aftermath of the terror attack, which took place on Halloween Day in New York City along the Hudson River on a bike path. So the suspect is still in the hospital. Apparently, he has asked to display the ISIS flag in his hospital room, something that has been declined. He regards that as an infringement upon his protection of free speech. So there you go. If you weren't already hot about this, you're probably hot now. Other American Muslims are talking about how what the man said, Allahu Akbar, which is translated as God is great or God is greatest, which he shouted when he exited the vehicle. And for many of us, a term that has become synonymous with jihad, there are Muslims in America who are trying to help all of us understand that, well, that's not what the word means to them. That's not what the word means in their prayer life. It's not what the word means or the phrase means when they use it frequently. And so they want it back. They want their word back. Well, I got a whole list of words I want back, just for the record, but I'm going to give a little time and attention right now to the appeal of Wajahat Ali. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a lawyer, and a lobbyist. And if his name is familiar to you, it's because he is the guy who, a number of years ago, after the election of Barack Obama, described Barack Obama in a public appearance as our first Muslim American president. And he added to that Allahu Akbar. And so, of course, that raised the eyebrows of some and raised the conversation among many. And so here is what Wajahat Ali has posted as an opinion piece in the New York Times today. In the print edition, it goes. The article is entitled "The Perversion of Allahu Akbar." In the online edition, it's entitled "I Want Allahu Akbar Back." Okay, Allahu Akbar. This is the lead paragraph. Wajahat Ali says it's Arabic for "God is greatest." Muslims, an eccentric tribe with over a billion members, say it several times in our five daily prayers. The phrase is also a convenient way to express just the right kind of gratitude in any situation. Now, Wajahat Ali is a storyteller and finds himself in situations in Washington, D.C. frequently as an interpreter of what would be regarded, what he would regard as mainstream Muslim ideology, what he describes as the majority of Muslims, which he claims to represent. And so he talks about the story, the narrative, the storyline of what it means to be Muslim in America and what it means to be Muslim around the world, and juxtaposes that against what he represents as a tiny fraction of Muslims who are terrorists, and like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and their sympathizers, who he believes have captured the American imagination, the public imagination. And so this is about how a story is told and the words that are used in the telling of a story. And when Allahu Akbar gets into a headline because a 29-year-old man plows with a rental truck along a bicycle path, killing people and injuring others, and then leaps from the truck proclaiming Allahu Akbar, that is not a storyline he wants perpetuated. He wants to wipe that storyline out, and he wants to replace it with what he says would be a reclamation of the phrase Allahu Akbar. He does not want it to be understood as a code for "it is terrorism." He wants it to be understood in the way that he understands it, which is a phrase of declaring God's goodness and something said to Allah in gratitude and thanksgiving for a myriad of things during the course of a day. And so he tells that story in this op-ed in the New York Times. Here's a paragraph that I want you to hear. And then I want you to hear the kinds of parallels that he is seeking to make. He says, it's easy to forget that language is often hijacked and weaponized by violent extremists. Some people yell Allahu Akbar. Others chant heritage, culture, and white pride. The preferred slogans of a killer don't make much difference to the people whose lives are lost or their loved ones, but they make all the difference in Americans' collective understanding of a tragedy. Now, let me just say that a number of years ago, I was asked by a reporter in D.C. to sort of forecast or predict what I anticipated would be the way these conversations were framed. A few years hence, what did I think the major issue was going to be? What did I think that the particular challenges were going to be to conservative Christians in America? And I said, it's going to be very challenging for anyone who has what might be viewed as a fundamental understanding of their particular faith, regardless of what it is, to not be seen as radical, to not be seen as a radical fundamentalist, and to not have other radical fundamentalist ideologies who are bad behavior, who are bad behaviors, people who are behaving badly out there in the culture, and have that brush be painted all the way across to people who have a fundamental or orthodox understanding of their own faith perspective. And this person said, what exactly do you mean? I said, well, here's exactly what I mean. I think that the concept of being a true believer in a religion is going to be associated with terrorism. It doesn't matter which true religion you are a practitioner of. The secular culture is going to eventually want no one to have a fundamentalist viewpoint of any religion, because they are going to grow to mistrust them all. I think we've pretty well arrived at that day. When it is fair game for people to draw a parallel in the New York Times between the actions of a person who meant to not only do deadly, murderous harm to the public, but also to communicate a particular message, when someone can parallel that with the way conservative Christians might want to influence the public conversation, and we are painted with the same brush, I got to come right out and tell you, I think we've arrived at that day. So I want you to be paying attention to the way the story is told. I want you to be paying attention to the language that's used. One of the points of agreement that I certainly have with Wajahat Ali is that language is powerful and that words can be co-opted and changed. I believe that the whole concept of marriage, the word marriage, has been completely perverted in our culture. I think identity is an issue. Identity itself has become an issue. We no longer know who we are because we no longer know whose we are, because we no longer know the God who created us. And so there's just the depth of confusion in our culture, not only surrounding marriage, but surrounding the, you know, what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, let alone what it means to be a man and a woman in relationship with each other in the context of marriage. So you can go down the list here. Words have been translated in ways in our culture where they no longer retain the meaning that they once had. And so everything requires translation. When anybody is talking about anything, you are now obligated to say, okay, exactly how are you using that word? Exactly what, by what definition are you using the term marriage? Because I'm not sure that you and I are operating from out of the same worldview. When I say marriage, here's what I mean. When you say marriage, is that what you mean? In many cases in this culture, the answer is going to be no. So when someone says Allahu Akbar, you are now obligated to say, what do you mean by that? What exactly do you mean by that? Hopefully the same is true when someone declares Jesus Christ or oh my God. Hopefully you are now in a position as a Christian to stop and say, what do you mean by that? I mean, when you say, you know, oh my God, out there in the culture today, are you actually declaring, is that a confessional statement? Oh my God? Like, are you praying? Is that a prayerful declaration to Yahweh? No, it's not. Most people are using OMG as slang. It's a misnomer. It's a misrepresentation of the name of God. It's the taking of the name of God in vain. I got all kinds of opportunities for you to engage in this conversation. It doesn't have to be Allahu Akbar. It can be OMG that you take issue with in the culture. So there you go. Okay. I want to lift up this story. I will just admit to you, I don't exactly know why this particular story is now popping on social media feeds, among, folks who I would describe as like Christian worldview commentators, and people who are reflecting on the Christian worldview. So my guess is there's an update to this story that I might have missed. So if one of you has seen it or read it, I am happy for you to pass it along to me. Again, I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. I'm easy to find at reconnectwithcarmen.com or on Facebook. So there you go. If you've got some updated info on this story, I'm happy to have it. Here's what was popping on the social media feeds of a bunch of my Christian worldview friends out there. It's a story that when I Googled it, it comes up as being a story that's 2 years old. So it could be that there's an update. Again, so what I Googled was Cosmo Mag promotes incest. That's what I Googled. So if you Google that, here's what's really going to be really, really disturbing. If you Google something like, I fell in love with my brother. Okay? Seriously, what if I fell in love with my brother? If you Google that, you're going to get 18 million sites returning, like site returns. Okay, how bizarre is that? If you Google Cosmo Mag promoting incest, okay, that's Cosmopolitan magazine, you get one return. So that's the one I clicked on, and it happens to be an article from October of 2015, which is why I didn't know why it's popping on my friend's social media feeds today. But here you go. The article is entitled, "This is what it's like to fall in love with your brother. Defying laws and societal taboos, one couple shares their undeniable connection." Okay, if you weren't a little wigged out and grossed out at sort of the decline of our culture, this story will do it. It features Melissa, who is 40, and Brian, who is 45, not their real names, obviously. Melissa's character enters the story following her... following, you know, just something going on in her own life that we don't exactly know what, but basically somebody on Facebook gets in touch with her and is saying things to her that only a person who knew a lot about her should probably know. So when we meet Melissa in the article, she is described to us as a person who grew up in suburban upper middle class Great Lakes, so the Great Lakes of Michigan. Her father committed suicide soon after her mother's mental health began to decline, and it wasn't too long that she was living in what I will describe as a very adult sexual environment. So when she's 14, her what is described as much older lover was allowed to move in to the house. So at 14, Melissa is already described as a person in an adult sexual relationship. So fast forward to when she's 40, and she gets a Facebook friend request from a guy who says, "Your dad is not your dad. Your mom lied to you your whole life about who your father was. You're actually the secret child of my dad, and I think we ought to meet." So there you go. That's quite a Facebook introduction. Her mother had apparently had an affair, become pregnant with this other man's child, and never told her so. Now, that is a lot to learn about yourself from some random individual on Facebook. Well, that led to meeting a bunch of other half-siblings, because there were apparently a lot of marriages on both of these sides of this particular story. And eventually, in the reconnecting with these sibling half-siblings, she meets who's described as Brian. And so here's here's where she describes the story as, quote, getting a little bit weird. Friends, if it's not weird to you already, that's just evidence of how far down the slippery slope of identity and sexuality we have spiraled. This story has multiple adulteries. It has suicide. It has failed marriages. It has lots of confused kids who've been lied to by their parents. And now we have a bunch of adults seeking some kind of identity with one another. These are two adults who I will not read any further in the Cosmo article, because it gets, salacious is might be my best word for it. Here's what I want to lift up from the article at this point. Both of these individuals, Melissa and Brian, when they met each other and found themselves attracted to each other, were confused by that. Melissa thinks, there's something wrong with me. Something isn't right. Brian, who, by the way, is married at the time, goes home to his wife, cannot have a relationship with her anymore because he is, quote, so turned on by his sister. He thinks to himself, I must be sick. I must be a terrible human being. Yes, in fact, people, this is, that's right. That's your conscience. That's the natural law operating as it should. That's the big no-no stop sign. But they did not stop. They plowed right through those stop signs. And 2 days later, they met. Now, I probably don't have to tell you what happened from there, but let's just say both of their marriages end at that point, because you cannot go back to your marriage after you do with your sibling what these two people choose to do with each other. And so two more marriages are destroyed. Children on both sides of this particular equation are then confused about the moral decision-making of their parents. And these people justify all of this by saying you just simply can't resist when you see in the other person, when everything inside you is vibrating. Here's the quote: when you see yourself in opposite form, as if you're gazing in a mirror, your cells know that this is your person. And then they go on to talk about the primal nature of their relationship. It's not primal, friends, it's animalistic. It's not, this is degrading to the human spirit. This is not the kind of relationship that we are supposed to have. So here's what I want to lift up. I don't want to be promoting a shame culture, but I do want to be asking the question, have we completely forgotten how to blush? Are we living in the days of Jeremiah, where, you know, Jeremiah tried to his concern about what was going on in the culture around him, tried to raise the alarm, and say, you know, God created you for more than this. You're made in the image of God, and you're made for more than this. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. You can join me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com, and we'll be right back after the break. What we give is all we have, and how we love is what we have. where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about. We are equipping you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. While you're at the website, we'd invite you to sign up for our email list. We'd also invite you to become a reconnector, a person who partners with us financially and prayerfully as we seek to extend the ministry to more and more people. Also, at the website, I want to highlight a resource that's posted there for you. That is relevant to the conversation that I am about to have with Christian Wright. So right now on our website at reconnectwithcarmen.com, we've got a series of conversations looking at persecution around the globe and how each of us can pray and get involved. So we want to be lifting up the church. We want to be focusing on this particular topic of persecuted Christians right now, because this coming Sunday is the International Day of Prayer for the persecuted Christians. So we want to be preparing our hearts in ways where we not only understand the plight of our brothers and sisters, but we actually begin to engage the subject matter of why they're being persecuted and how we might help and intervene as advocates. So what kind of prayers are they asking for? Well, a part of what we have posted for you is our conversation with Nick Ripken. It's a powerful conversation about what persecuted Christians around the globe actually want us to be praying for and how they want us to be praying. And so we've got all kinds of stories posted for you there, as well as a number of interviews on this particular subject. So again, go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, look for our new e-booklet, which is a special report, renewing the mind on the subject of real persecution. And you can also go to opendoors.usa for more subject matter or more on this particular subject matter. So right now, I want to have a conversation with Kristen Wright. Kristen works within the U.S. Congress at the U.S. State Department, at the White House, at the UN in New York to raise awareness of religious repression in countries throughout the world. She works extensively with lots of other non-governmental organizations and individuals on human rights issues and religious freedom initiatives, and is an active member of the International Religious Freedom Roundtable based in Washington, D.C. In her work at Open Doors, she goes to countries all around the globe, meeting people who are experiencing persecution firsthand, as well as those who are able to tell the stories of those who have been persecuted unto death and become martyrs for the faith. So you can find out more about what Kristen does at Open Doors USA, and you can also check out the Open Doors USA UN petition, which is at the Open Doors USA website. Kristen, welcome to the Reconnect.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So as the advocacy director for Open Doors USA, which folks can follow on Twitter at Open Doors USA, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing around the world right now and maybe how it compares to what folks have experienced in other generations.
Well, what we're seeing actually is absolutely unprecedented levels of persecution around the world. Today, actually, more than 3/4 of the world's population exists and lives under some form of religious persecution. And Open Doors internationally works in 60 countries around the globe where Christians are facing the most severe persecution simply because of their faith. And so one area of the world that we're particularly active in working with Christians on the ground would be the Middle East, in particular Iraq and Syria. And that is what has led us to launch our campaign, A Million Voices of Hope for the Middle East. And this is not just an advocacy campaign, it's a prayer campaign, it's a campaign for support. And actually, one of the most unique aspects of our Million Voices of Hope campaign is the fact that it is not only a campaign for persecuted Christians in the Middle East, but also by persecuted Christians in the Middle East.
There's a lot of power, not only in praying for, not only a lot of power in praying for someone, but a ton of power in praying with someone. So why don't you tell us, why don't you tell us a story about, maybe some of the someone who you have met in the Middle East with whom we are praying as a part of this initiative.
Yes. So I have visited Iraq shortly after Christians were displaced en masse from their homelands along the Nineveh Plain, and visited a number of the IDP camps where they were residing, living in very critical conditions. And I met with a church leader who told me, you know, we can actually feel the prayers of Christians around the world. And so I think that that's one tangible example where you can see that your efforts are really making a difference, whether it's signing a petition on opendoorsusa.org. That's where our Million Voices of Hope campaign is posted right now, right on the homepage. But also lifting up our brothers and sisters in prayer makes them feel so encouraged.
All right, so I've clicked on Open Doors USA, and I'm seeing the Hope for the Middle East. Friends, it's really easy to sign the petition. You just put your first name, your last name, and your email address. I'm going to encourage people to do that right now. One of the things it says on here, it talks about the destruction. Talk with us a little bit about when Christians do have the opportunity to return to these communities where they once lived in Syria and Iraq that have been decimated by ISIS. Tell us what they're returning to, and then tell us like how we can not only be praying, but how we can engage as fellow believers in helping them to move back to communities.
Well, one of the challenges right now is that it's a very messy situation on the ground in Iraq right now, as I'm sure you're aware. And so we are actively assisting Christian families in returning, if they wish, to their homelands along the Nineveh Plain. But think of the dangers of returning to areas that were just only recently occupied by ISIS. It's incredibly dangerous. And so these Christians need your prayers, they need your support and their encouragement. And it's also crucial to be standing with them. You know, we asked Christians on the ground in Iraq and Syria what would give them hope. And they laid out a couple of different things. One of those was good living conditions. Another was a role in the rebuilding and reshaping of their society after the conflict. And so Christians really want to play a role in the new country and in the way that things are as they're moving forward. And so we want to support them in that.
So one of the things that I love about this Hope for the Middle East million, remind me the name of it again, because I have to scroll back up on my page, because I'm actually on the page. Yeah, so 1 million voices of hope. I think that sometimes, Kristen, what we, you know, we're like, oh, I'm just one voice and my voice isn't going to count for much. And, you know, and you really need the U.S. government and the United Nations to move in order for substantive change to happen. You know, what's my one little voice going to do? Tell people what the power of a million voices does in terms of advocacy.
Well, it certainly makes a statement. That is for sure. It definitely shows we're actually at just over 500,000 signatures right now, and we're hoping to make it all the way to 1 million by December of this year. And I want to actually just encourage listeners that these signatures aren't just coming from Christians in the United States. They're actually coming from more than 140 countries all over the globe. So that's really a huge encouragement that you're not only speaking up for persecuted Christians, but you're standing with and alongside them as Christians in Iraq and Syria and other countries have signed this exact same petition that we will be delivering to, ideally, the UN Secretary General in December. So I just want to encourage listeners, again, to go to opendoorsusa.org to sign the petition and to speak out and speak with our persecuted brothers and sisters.
All right, I just signed the petition, Kristen, at Open Doors USA.
Thank you, Carly.
I'm going to encourage. Yeah, I'm going to encourage other people to do it too. It was that easy. I could actually do it multitasking while we were talking. So, friends, if I will post it on all of my social media, but it's really simple. Go to opendoorsusa.org and sign the petition. That's how easy it is. And then you could actually use your own social media platform to encourage others to do the same. This particular week that we are in, we're trying to really focus people on this issue as we move into this weekend, when on Sunday, lots of churches are going to be engaged together in the International Day of Prayer for Persecuted Christians. So it just seems really timely, Kristen, for us to be lifting this up. What else do you want to address today?
It certainly is. And actually, to that point, I would really love to encourage our listening audience to share the petition. That is a huge thing. A lot of people have signed this petition. As you mentioned, it takes 2 seconds to do it. It's an easy lift. But what we really need are people to share the petition, particularly during this week where people are remembering the persecuted church, let's get the word out as much as possible. And just a reminder that Christians in the Middle East, this is a very volatile time for them right now. It's an incredibly difficult time, and we want them to feel our support. There are also opportunities to help beyond advocacy at opendoorsusa.org. You can actually give to help a family to rebuild their home on the Nineveh Plain. You can give to assist in trauma counseling. You can give to assist in education for Christian children. There are so many different opportunities, not just for giving, but also for praying. Open Doors has the World Watch List that chronicles the countries where it is worst in the world to be a Christian. You can learn more about very specific ways to pray for our persecuted brothers and sisters there as well.
I know that at our in my church, or the church that I attend, it's not my church, it's Jesus's church, but in the church that I attend, every single week we focus on a different country where our brothers and sisters are living under persecution. And so, you know, just in terms of giving people ideas for ways that they can be engaging this subject and ways that they can be opening their mind, their heart, their family to the reality that we have people with whom we're going to spend eternity as brothers and sisters in Christ, fellow citizens of the kingdom of heaven, who in the midst of the kingdoms of this world are living under under conditions and under regimes that we really cannot imagine. So in addition to the Middle East, Kristen, are there some other places around the world that just God just really puts them on your heart in a special way? And can you tell us why?
Yes, I've had the privilege of traveling to a number of countries. Actually, I've been to so far 16 of the 60 countries where Open Doors is at work on the ground. And one of those countries that has particularly captured my heart is Nigeria. If you look at what has continuously transpired in Nigeria, you're seeing the severe persecution of Christians at the hands of Boko Haram, forced conversions, kidnappings, rape. The Chibok girls, this is a story that a lot of us can recognize that's kind of lost its place in mass media coverage. But it's the story of the kidnapping of many Christian girls at the hands of Boko Haram. And I think that it's urgent now more than ever for us to be lifting up our brothers and sisters in Nigeria who are facing such a crisis, as particularly as this intersects with the famine as well.
I know that we recognize that some of those girls have been, have been released reunited with their families. But we've talked about here on the Reconnect, Kristen, that, you know, the reality of returning to even your family or a community after the kinds of experiences these girls have had is its own kind of trauma and its own kind of shame. And so I think that a renewed sort of the renewal of prayers for folks in these in these circumstances and in these places that we frankly cannot imagine is just always good for us to be mindful of. I think that, you know, we have a tendency here in the United States to use the word persecution or to imagine that we're being, you know, persecuted because somehow our freedoms are being infringed upon, or people are making fun of us or calling us names because of our particular convictions related to biblical Christianity. But what other people are experiencing around the globe, you know, persecution unto death for Jesus Christ, the actual spilling of blood, and the trauma of the kinds of things that you're talking about, forced conversion and rape, and the list goes on and on and on. I really think that one of the things that Open Doors USA helps us have is perspective. And so, you know, I want to be sure that you pass along to your colleagues the way that what you're doing is so important for the life of the church in America, so that we can actually have a window into and a voice in the conversations about what's happening to our brothers and sisters around the world.
That's right, exactly. I think it does give us context. I know that it certainly has given me context every time that I've had the privilege of traveling and meeting with people who face very severe persecution simply because of their faith. I always come away challenged and encouraged and even inspired at the way that they're living their lives. I'm also inspired by my colleagues on the ground and the people that courageously work on the field with Open Doors, obviously taking risks. But that's one of the things that our founder, Brother Andrew, I was able to meet with him personally some time ago, and he actually told me something that I will never forget, which is that a lot of times people say when they're saying goodbye to someone, oh, take care. that he said what we should say to each other is take risks. And that's certainly the way of life for Christians around the globe, and I think it's a challenge to all of us.
Can you help me understand one more thing before we let you go? And I thank you so much for joining us today. I know that in addition to what Christians might like understand as Christian programs, I mean, you guys obviously do Bible and gospel development. You do Christian community restoration. But talk with me about the women and children advancement portion of what you guys do in Open Doors USA, and help my listeners understand why that is so important in the places where you're working.
Certainly. Well, in many cases, there is an additional layer of persecution faced by women in particular. Many of our listeners will be aware of the concept of gender-based violence occurring in countries throughout the Middle East, throughout North Africa. In many countries throughout the world, there are issues where women already face odds and face challenges. They're already considered to be second-class citizens in many ways, without many of the rights of men. And in addition to this, to be a Christian, for instance, in a country like Egypt, as an example, this means that Christian women can be raped, they can be abused, and then there is not justice done for them. And I would say that this is also the same similar situation in Pakistan and in other countries. So this is something where we are working to empower women and empower children. And for women, this is certainly a big place in my heart for these projects, but they're working to help women to support their families, to be economically secure, and to learn to read, to learn to write, have an education and opportunities that they might not otherwise have. And I think that that speaks to just a huge aspect of our work, which is, coming alongside our Christian brothers and sisters and addressing their needs, not going into it with whatever our agenda is, but seeing what the needs really are and working to address those.
Kristen, thank you so much for all that you are doing. Thank you for Open Doors USA. Again, folks, you want to go to Open Doors USA. And you want to sign the petition. So the website is opendoorsusa.org. You can follow them on Twitter at opendoorsusa. And you can tweet to me at Carmen LaBurge after you have signed the petition and joined me in this effort to not only raise awareness about the concerns that we have for Christians living in persecuted environments, but specifically for the Christians in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria, and the particular the needs that they're experiencing right now, as ISIS is being pressed down, the opportunity to move back into the Nineveh Plain and those communities is essential, but it's also incredibly difficult. They need protection. They need all kinds of things. They certainly need the right of equal citizenship, and they need the dignity of a place to live that's reasonable. And they frankly need our help in order to help them get their place at the table in the ongoing conversations about rebuilding. So let's join not only in prayer, but let's join our voices together as a million voices of hope in this Open Doors USA challenge. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us again today on The Reconnect.
Thank you so much.
All right, friends, join me. Like, let us be people who lend our voices to this effort to raise a million voices of hope in terms of the situation being faced by our Christian brothers and sisters in the Middle East. Hey, we're gonna spend time tomorrow specifically talking about Israel, and I just wanted to, before we go today, lift up that this is the 100th anniversary. This is the centennial of the signing of the Balfour Declaration, or the issuance of the Balfour Declaration. And some of you are saying, Balfour, isn't that like the ring company that made my ring at graduation when I graduated from high school? Isn't that Balfour? Yeah, that's actually the same name, but this is a different issue. So the Balfour Declaration was signed 100 years ago today, maybe one of the most politically fraught 67-word missives in all of human history. So what happened after the Balfour Declaration was issued as a public letter on November the 2nd, 1917, was that what we now know as Israel, right, was designated as a home for the Jewish people. And so you say to yourself, well, that's odd. I feel like that happens in the Old Testament of the Bible. Yes, but in the generation of nation states following the world wars, the conversation arose about how the former Ottoman Empire in particular was going to be carved up. And so the Western powers were busy carving up the crumbling Ottoman Empire, and the conversation was being had what to do with all the Jews. I mean, I'll just tell you, that's maybe a crass way of putting it, but that's pretty much what the conversation was about. So the Balfour Declaration was one piece of a series of British diplomatic efforts where the British were seeking to reshape the map of the modern Middle East. So in 1916, Britain had already agreed in secret with France and Russia to a division of the Ottoman Empire. And so Palestine, they had already agreed in this little secret agreement in 1916, was going to be under what would be called joint international control. And it was a year later, with the Bolshevik Revolution, that some of those plans, you know, sort of fell apart. And Britain then sought to consolidate this buffer between the French-dominated Levant. You'll recognize that many of these people groups in the Middle East have French as a part of their language. Well, that's because that was French-controlled territory. And then we have these colonial concerns of Egypt, of Britain in Egypt. So Britain really wanted a buffer. So we say to ourselves, oh, it was all out of this gracious concern for the Jews that the Brits wanted to issue this Balfour Declaration and wanted to create a homeland for the Jews. Not necessarily, not really precisely that altruistic of the Brits. In fact, what they were seeking to do was create a buffer between themselves and the French, who they still regarded as an enemy of the day. Okay, so we fast forward 100 years later, and we have the reality of Israel, which declared its full independence in 1948. And then we have the issues with those who we would describe as Palestinians, who are technically still refugees, which is really an odd reality, because refugee status is not supposed to span more than a generation. So it's a complicated subject matter. We're going to talk more about it tomorrow with a person who knows a whole lot more about it than I do. But I wanted to alert you to that, because you may be hearing in the nightly news tonight about rumblings in Palestine, as there were lots of protests planned today in the Palestinian territories marking the centennial of this formal statement, which the Palestinians still view as the first instrument of what is called their dispossession. So the Palestinian view of the Balfour Declaration, the Israeli view of the Balfour Declaration, the geopolitical view of the Balfour Declaration, all are essential. You're going to hear reporting today about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appearing in London alongside his British counterpart Theresa May, commemorating this 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. And I wanted to be sure that you knew what it was, so that you as a Christian would know how to enter into the conversation of this day about that particular subject. So your equipping on that matter is this. Israel in the Old Testament is understood to be the people of God, the chosen people of God. Israel is also the name of a territory in the Old Testament. Israel is also a secular geopolitical Jewish state today. And it's a complicated conversation when we start talking about all of those Israels. Okay, friends, that's all we got time for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, and share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.